The following KOPN podcast is made possible by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please consider a donation to listener-supported community radio, KOPN. You can donate securely on our website at kopn.org.
You're listening to 89.5 FM KOPN Columbia, Mid-Missouri's source for in-depth news, diverse talk, and music of the world. It's more than radio. It's community radio on the web at kopn.org with listeners locally listening in Hartsburg, Murray, Wilton, and Easley.
This is my one.
Welcome to Thought Crime Radio here in at KOP in Columbia, Missouri. This is Janelle, and I'm in the studio with Rich. And Thought Crime Radio is about the human rights of the baby. So we're talking about a wide variety of issues that most people probably have not even thought relate to how we are born.
People have been trusting authority figures in the medical community for over a century now to deliver babies from the womb into the world. And birth is about much more than just getting the baby from point A to point B. It's about nature's blueprint calls for the establishing of a primal emotional bond between the mother and the baby, the function of which is to protect, so the mother will protect the baby from authority figures, essentially, in white coats in our obstetrical wards. At least that would be one positive aspect of a natural birth. Empowered women, powerful women is what we're talking about. Women who are empowered to realize their own potential as well as protect their babies. And we've been abdicating that that function of motherhood as well as fatherhood to people who claim to know what they're talking about, and frankly they do not. Before we go into that, though, I'd just like to get into some more immediate issues, which is the swine flu vaccine issue. Reports coming out from in the media now state that the government is talking about a militarized, forced mass vaccination campaign to allegedly protect us from the swine flu. There's several issues to be concerned about this. One is that swine flu, at least in its current form, is less virulent than ordinary flu. This is not a big deal. This is something that we deal with every year, and yet they are treating it as if we're dealing with a new Spanish flu epidemic or worse. They're actually talking about taking children out of schools and over their parents' objections and vaccinating them and even quarantining them. Another issue is that some of these vaccines, possibly all of them, I'm not sure, but at least some of them will contain thimerosal. Thimerosal is a antifungicide that is included in multi-dose vaccine vials. It is 50% mercury, and based on research that came out in 2005, which is virtually unknown outside of the research community, it is now known that children with a certain genetic profile, which can be readily screened for, are vulnerable to heavy metal poisoning, and all of the children in a sample of 80 autistic children and approximately 80 non-autistic children. The children with autism had a specific genetic profile. The children without autism had a normal genetic profile. And let me just read from the Science News of April 16, 2005. It says, "In a study of the blood of some apparently healthy children, the biochemistry of one sample stood out. It came from an autistic boy. Curious, the researcher got blood samples from 20 other autistic children. All exhibited a similar unusual biochemical fingerprint, which the researcher has now confirmed in an additional 75 autistic children. None of the children in a comparison group of 75 neurologically healthy kids carried the fingerprint in his or her blood. The autistic youngsters had unusually low concentrations of the antioxidant glutathione in their cells. Their ratio of active glutathione to its inactive breakdown products also was unusually low. This pattern is consistent with an inability to detoxify poisons, especially heavy metals such as mercury or lead." Okay, so this research, this is as close to proof as you're likely to find in an empirical study. If you have this genetic trait, at least if you were a child in the United States, it's typically exposed to heavy metal poisoning via vaccines, you're virtually guaranteed to get autism. And they can screen for this genetic trait. They don't have to expose these children needlessly, and yet they are covering this up because of the huge legal liabilities involved in admitting that medicine has been subjecting children to a lifetime of misery. The other component in this swine flu vaccine is a something called an adjuvant. It's called squalene. The function of an adjuvant in a vaccine is to hype up the immune system. It's basically a generalized insult to the immune system to try to get it to pay attention to the biological ingredients in the vaccine and treat it as a foreign invader to be fought. Squalene triggers an immune reaction, which can degrade into chronic autoimmune condition. It's been linked to Gulf War syndrome pretty conclusively. According to February 2000 issue of Experimental Molecular Pathology, says that the substantial majority, 95% of overtly ill Gulf War syndrome patients, troops who had been deployed to the Gulf in the first Gulf War, had antibodies to squalene. Squalene was included in the anthrax vaccine that was injected into these soldiers. 100% of the Gulf War syndrome patients immunized for Desert Shield, Desert Storm, who did not deploy but had the same signs and symptoms as those who did deploy, had antibodies to squalene. So, in other words, 95% of those who were actually deployed had antibodies to squalene. So there are probably, you know, a small 5% rate of something that looks like Gulf War syndrome that was caused by something else, possibly depleted uranium or something. But the overwhelming majority has a conclusive connection to the use of squalene in vaccines. So our so-called authorities are about to subject us to a very profitable campaign, profitable for a small number of pharmaceutical companies, of needless vaccination with virtually untested vaccines that include ingredients that are well known now in the research community to be connected with both Gulf War syndrome and autism. So this is coming down the pike. They're talking about maybe late September or October sometime when they're going to start this forcible campaign. And the first targeted people in this campaign is going to be children. Children in schools are going to be treated as test subjects in this vast experiment.
And babies. So this is a heavy-duty subject here, and we have another heavy-duty subject to talk about. When we think about babies, we think, ooh, aw, we're so excited to see the little babies, but we really don't think about what we're doing to the babies, and that's what we're talking about here on Thought Crime Radio, the human rights of the babies. The song that we played was Stevie Wonder's song, Isn't She Lovely, and that's a song about his daughter. And at the beginning of the song and at the end of the song, you can hear his daughter. At the beginning, she's within a minute old. Those are her cries. And then at the end, Stevie Wonder talking and playing with his baby. And I was really surprised when I looked up this music to find out that everywhere on the web and when the song is played, the baby's cries, the baby at the beginning is taken off. I didn't know that was on the song.
What does that say about our respect for babies? What does it mean when a baby cries?
And what about in our society when we expect parents to keep their babies hushed? Often, because I work with babies, the moms will be, shh, 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 it's okay, it's okay. When baby's crying in the line at the grocery store, in a restaurant or someplace, and people start looking at the mother, and she starts to take on that guilt and shame of, well, I have to quiet the baby. But this is a brand new human being talking to us. We need to support that mother to care for her baby, not expect her to hush the baby. The baby's communicating. And we're really, really excited today to have a guest on our show who is the internationally known expert on babies and babies' awareness and consciousness. David Dr. Chamberlain is a psychologist, teacher, and pioneer in the new field of prenatal psychology. He's the author of The Mind of Your Newborn Baby that was originally published under the title Babies Remember Birth in 1988, and I think it's been translated into 22 languages since then. He's the co-founder of the Association for Pre- and Perinatal Psychology and Health, which is an organization of professionals from diverse disciplines like psychology, obstetrics, midwifery, nursing, trauma healing, childbirth educators, doulas, from virtually all over the world. In fact, Dr. Chamberlain is internationally known for his work and is a frequent speaker at international conferences. He is actually currently finishing his second book, which is called Windows on the Womb, Your First 9 Months, and preparing for a 3-week tour in September of countries in Europe where he is going to be sharing the ideas from this new book. David Chamberlain has been a key person in my professional development working with babies, and I am very, very happy to have him with us to talk to us about our subject today, which is circumcision. And there is no other time in a baby's life, in a man's life, in a little boy's life, when he will cry like he does when he is circumcised, and strangers doing this to him will not acknowledge his cries. First, I think Rich is going to talk a little bit about what actually happens during the circumcision, and then we're going to have Dr. Chamberlain come on and talk to us about how babies are conscious and how it is that babies remember this, and how it is that a man, even though he doesn't consciously remember it, somewhere in him he remembers the trauma that he experienced when he was circumcised. And I'd like to have David say hi if you're on. Are you there, David? Oh. Okay. David, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yay.
Hallelujah.
Thank you.
Hi, Rick.
Hi. I'm so glad that you came on the show with us. This is quite an honor for us. This is to have a world-renowned expert.
Well, I'm learning about vaccinations from you.
All right, we have an out-of-control medical profession, and unfortunately the children are paying the price.
Yes.
So do you want to briefly explain?
Okay, let me just go over. First of all, last week we talked about the social control functions of circumcision. And we actually have a website. Eventually it will be thoughtcrimeradio.net, but that's not registered yet. It's currently available as thoughtcrimeradio.blogspot.com. And so you can look up a lot of this stuff and get some of the transcript from the previous show there. Let me just read from a paper that I wrote some time ago about how a circumcision is actually performed. And by the way, despite widespread misconception, approximately 50% or more of circumcisions in this country are performed without any anesthetic whatsoever. Okay, so we can dispense with that myth. The typical circumcisions are still performed without anesthetic of any kind. So because the foreskin of an infant is attached to the head of the penis by the same tissue that bonds a fingernail to a finger, it must be skinned away before it can be cut off. So the doctor forces a metal probe between the foreskin and the head and tears apart this flesh, called synchnia, which bonds them together. Next, the doctor has several options for the actual amputation. One commonly used device for this step is called a gonco clamp. This essentially functions as a thumb screw for the foreskin. Surgical scissors are used to cut a slit along the length of the foreskin in order to insert a metal bell which serves as one jaw of the clamp. The foreskin is pulled over the bell and the outer jaw of the clamp is attached. Then by tightening a screw, the foreskin, one of the most densely innervated tissues of the body, and actually the core erogenous sexual tissue of the human body, is audibly crushed. You can hear it being crushed, like crushing a piece of gristle in your teeth, is audibly crushed along two lines, inner and outer foreskin, around its circumference. Now, since all the nerves of the foreskin pass through this crush line, the pain perception may be similar to that of putting the entire erogenous surface of the penis in a vise. The clamp is left on for a few minutes to promote blood clotting, then the foreskin is cut off at the crush line. Afterwards, the raw, bleeding, formerly internal organ is wrapped in bandages and a diaper and then repeatedly burned with urine and its breakdown product ammonia and exposed to infectious fecal matter while healing.
That's pretty intense. So this last Saturday on Core Issues, there was a discussion about circumcision as well, where Tyree and Jessica were discussing, as a man and as a woman expecting a baby, the pros and cons. And one of the things we didn't get to was HIV prevention being used as a reason for promoting circumcision now. And in the next 2 weeks, Marilyn Milos, who is the founder of NoCirc, will be here to talk about that. And we also didn't get to talk about the emotional aspects for the male and the sexuality of both. And Veronica Monet, a sex therapist, will be joining us also in the next couple of weeks. But here today on the radio, we have Dr. David Chamberlain. And I want to start out, David, by telling you something that that came up on Saturday. It came up that that men who were uncircumcised as babies, but for whatever reason chose to or needed to be circumcised as a man, will talk about how horrible it is and how he wishes that he had it done as a baby. And that is a common thing being said to promote circumcision as a baby. And we want to ask you about how it is that we humans do believe or that do remember birth and how we do remember trauma in the beginning.
Well, this gentleman is making a very obvious mistake, but it's a mistake based upon ignorance of how the memory works in a very small child and the rest of us. When he thought it would have been better if he had it when he was a baby, it's because the general view, even in medicine, is that babies don't feel it, which is a weird thing from our standpoint, but the vast majority of people believe this for at least the last 100 years. We thought that there was no brain working at all in a newborn baby. And we learned that from medicine. That was medical belief coming, to students in medical schools. They were taught that the baby is not able to feel anything. And so if once you believe that, then it seems okay to do anything you need to do for the baby medically. And of course, it just bypasses the reality that they were all wrong about the baby not being able to feel anything. It was just a terrible misunderstanding, really a tragic misunderstanding about babies in general. And so without a brain, they didn't see, they couldn't imagine how a baby could know that it was in pain. And they didn't believe the baby itself. Babies have powerful body language. We all know that they can scream and cry. It's one of the trademarks of hospital birth, is babies crying. And I think probably when they hear the baby crying, excuse me,
So we're talking with Dr. David Chamberlain, a prenatal psychologist who wrote The Mind of Your Newborn Baby, and we're talking about the memory of a baby.
Can I just mention something? Let me interject something here. Babies do not just cry when they're being circumcised, okay? The sound that's coming out of them is more accurately described as a scream, the kind of scream that you emit when you're running out of air in your lungs to make a sound. They basically wind up with their chests completely collapsed without air, trying to force more air out of their vocal cords, screaming, okay? The neocon, the Bush administration's definition of torture their definition of torture doesn't kick in until there is internal organ failure, okay, by the standards of the previous administration. Well, in fact, circumcision meets this standard because one of the possible consequences of neonatal circumcision is actually gastric rupture, okay, where the stomach actually busts wide open and releases, you know, juices into the abdominal cavity, which is, of course, a serious problem.
And there are deaths associated with circumcision.
Yes,
in our country.
There are deaths from infection. I'm not even talking about the deaths that result when an adult man grows up and is acting out trying to deal with the trauma that was subjected to him at a time when he can't even remember what was going on, and he just winds up committing suicide, because now they know that even specific suicide methods are oftentimes connected to early childhood trauma.
Yeah. So, David, can you...
Yes, thanks for that, Rick. I was talking about the larger picture that, in general, we don't respect any kind of crying from babies. And those of us in therapy know that babies need to cry when they're really upset. But what really bothers me is that medically trained people don't listen to that cry at birth. They don't think that it's anything real, because they don't think the baby has enough brain to interpret what's happening. Now, this was a tragic misstep. Terrible misunderstanding in medicine. And of course, when babies are using their body language as they do during circumcision, my gosh, this, as I often say, they're screaming bloody murder.
They're strapped down to a table, right? They're strapped down with Velcro straps.
Usually, yes. It's called a circumstraint. Hospitals buy these little cradles and strap babies in for the convenience of the surgeon. But, yeah, they're screaming bloody murder because they're in panic, they're in terrible pain. And to make it all much worse, nobody's paying any attention.
Right. And they're with strangers, most often.
Isn't that a
fault? Yes, they're with strangers. In some cases where you have a Jewish ritual and the rabbi is doing it,
right.
You might have a father standing by, you might have a mother, but they've learned not to be around for this because it's very, very upsetting.
And but so
they use an anesthetic in terms of wine. They're hoping that the baby will not react very strongly during the ceremony. But all these adults are kidding themselves. The babies know what's happening.
Didn't this myth about babies not feeling pain originate from the use of obstetrical drugs, and babies are oftentimes sedated by obstetrical drugs at the time of circumcision, but it's basically a toss-up as to whether they'll be fully awake or not?
Well, actually, I think it's a little the other way around, that somewhere back there over 100 years ago, they decided that babies don't need any anesthetic for the reasons that I've been talking about. And so they didn't give it to babies. And not only did they discriminate against babies, they were making the decision for a lot of people that they didn't need anesthetic for surgery.
But I mean, I'm talking about the drugs that they gave the woman during birth. Like the
yeah, but they didn't see, they claimed not to believe that there would be a spillover to the baby.
So what you're saying is that because of this belief that this baby's brain isn't really functioning, baby won't remember, baby doesn't feel, you said before, they can just do whatever they want.
And so, that's right.
So that's where the obstetric drugs come in, the forceps, the vacuum, the surgical birth. Like, it doesn't matter because the baby won't remember it.
They've even done open-heart surgery on babies using paralytic agents without bothering to give them pain relief.
Exactly.
But you have 30 or 40 years of research and experience to tell us otherwise?
Well, it's clear in medical history there are books about this, specifically about how they came to a decision of who needed anesthetic. This was around the time that ether vapors were invented, and they knew that it conferred an not only an analgesic, but anesthetic state. And while they really could hardly wait to use it in general surgery with adults, they had a big discussion in the medical field about who really needed it. And because we're talking about babies today, I'm bringing it in that they thought babies could be left out. And they didn't believe babies would need it. And when they did surgery on babies and the babies kind of passed out or went into shock, the doctors were comforted by looking at the baby, and they would say, well, look, this baby is not finding this surgery difficult. And they were misinterpreting the whole situation.
And so today we still have these rituals going on where the babies are disregarded. And so that somebody who believes that they could be circumcised, should be circumcised as a child, as a baby, rather than as an adult, are really misinformed.
But the fact is that the research is in now. I mean, we've known since at least the mid-70s that babies, at least conscious babies, are fully capable of experiencing and imprinting their earliest experiences.
Yes, but that's been a hard sell. Because there's this underlying resistance in the medical world, both those who teach in the medical school and those who listen and have to measure up to what their professors demand. There's a great resistance there to learning that an infant is fully sentient and is learning and remembering from all of its experiences. We have plenty of data. But unfortunately, but importantly, that is not the deciding criterion. We have a lot of information from research that we pay no attention to. And we do that usually because we've already made up our minds that something is true. You can see this is not only in the medical world. It's
right.
True all around, educationally, scientifically. All of us so-called professionals tend to decide at some point what we believe, and we just go on believing it, even though the evidence piles up that we were wrong in the first place.
But this is such a critical issue for our survival as a society that we recognize this, because it really is conditioning our entire society to be a nation of sociopaths and traumatized people acting out unconscious compulsions.
Yes, I think you're right. The underlying issue here is that if we want a good society, we need people to relate to each other in a comfortable, normal, rational, peaceful way. Otherwise, you don't have a sane society, a creative, peaceful society. So what we're talking about is one of the most undesirable imprints at a very early stage of learning, when we torture babies in the name of good medicine. That doesn't change the fact that the babies know they're being tortured, can't figure out who or why this would happen to them, and then they're left spinning. Nobody ever explains how the parents were related to this event. So the babies stay confused about this for a long time, and the trauma that they experienced is driving their behavior day by day. Ordinary social behavior.
Can you explain for the audience the idea of imprinting?
Yes. Imprinting is one of the words in psychology that we use to describe learning. And it's a particular kind of learning, different from school type learning, where you usually have to have something repeated over and over again before you finally get it. But this is not true of imprinting. An imprint is as it sounds. It's like being stamped and burned, like cattle are branded. It's imprinted in your system, and only one event is needed. One very dramatic, horrible event will teach you a lesson of some sort right away. And that imprinting tends to stay there deep in your memory. It's not the kind of thing that you hear about again, and usually it's not even brought up again, but it's still down deep inside the baby, and that's all of us. And that means that it's a type of memory that programs your behavior unconsciously. We talk about memory in one sense as something that we know or don't know or did know, and we can forget it for a while, but we really do know it, and it'll come back. There's that kind of memory. But unconscious memory is not like that. Unconscious memory goes in at a very deep level, and it stays there. The conscious mind seems unaware of it and can't explain it because it's just not within reach. This is what makes it so dangerous and so upsetting, so damaging. It's down so deep that the person who's having, who has it inside doesn't remember what it was and how it's affecting them. So that's a terrible combination.
And we know that babies, that humans coming in are love. They're just love. And so here you have, in the very beginning, this shock and then this conflict that becomes this subconscious memory that's always in conflict with the good in who I am.
Yes, this is especially true if a baby's had a very normal course of time in its mother's womb and has proceeded from month to month without shocks and screaming and violence and other such things. A baby then doesn't get distracted away from its, I think, its essential being as a nonviolent human. That baby is the baby that really can help us make a civilized world. They're part of the solution, not part of the problem, as we say. They have the kind of attitude coming into the world because of they've been treated well. They have the attitude that's the thing to do in this world. You feel well, you treat others well, and you're well. If only we could have babies being born under those conditions, of course, we'd be very, very lucky and a lot better off than we are now.
There are some cultures that do respect babies from the moment of birth.
And there's a movement here.
Yes. And these cultures are associated with high rates of peaceful sociology.
Definitely. And I'd go even farther, I reckon, and point to the cultures that know that life begins before conception. And they don't even wait to try to protect life in the womb. They know before they make sex to have that baby that they're already in touch with the spirit of the baby and they have an agreement with each other. And like the Tibetans used to believe that. In modern times, it's hard to know what a culture believes because it's been so drilled full of holes and infected, in a sense, by other cultures, like Western medicine, teaching in foreign cultures things that really go against that culture. We find that I'm thinking of a case of circumcision, that in Korea they didn't ever do circumcision until about 50 years ago, when they learned from American medicine that it was a good thing to do. And although they had a long cultural tradition of not circumcising, by golly, they went ahead and started it, and they're going strong. Isn't that just horrible?
It is, and it's hard to believe. I mean, it's hard to figure out, how does this happen? How does a whole culture change like that? But it has to go back to that shock that you're talking about, and how this shocked human being then goes back to his mama and doesn't connect with her, and life continues.
Yes.
There's so many opportunities here for intergenerational self-perpetuating behavior that really needs to be fully appreciated if we're going to change this culture. We are creating generation after generation of people who will subject their own children to this kind of abuse.
That's such a frightening truth. Once you get on the wrong track, it begins to spread.
It's an infection.
It is an infection, much more dangerous than any of these flus that we're talking about and you were telling us about earlier.
Yeah, that's... And you go around the world, and in other cultures, in other countries in Europe, they don't circumcise. In this country, I think it was up to 90% at one point before Marilyn Milo started her work, and now I understand it's down to about 50%, and it's a real...
Yes, and falling.
It's been a real battle. It's been like a 30-year battle.
A terrible battle.
And
I'd like to cite one of the reasons how these things get going, and I'm going to call it science. Science was kind of at the peak of its popularity and influence in the mid-20th century, when we started to do a lot of things that were not good for babies. But science was an authority. People believed in science. They wanted scientists to tell us what the truth was and to educate us. And we became believers. We didn't challenge science. We just tended to believe science. And that was a terrible mistake. Science was a god for us, largely through the 20th century. And it's only late in the game that we pick up the fact that science is not pure, that sometimes it betrays itself, like it doesn't follow the truth, it follows its own prejudices or its own orthodox beliefs.
and its own institutional conflicts of interest. Could I mention an article in today's New York Times talking about, the title of the article is Officials Weigh Circumcision to Fight HIV Risk.
Oh, no, in this day and age, they're still talking about that.
They're still talking about that. And now we know, one of the biggest experimental debunking of this whole notion can be seen in the comparison of the HIV epidemiology between the United States and Europe. Europe has virtually, medical circumcision in Europe is virtually unknown.
Yeah.
In the United States, maybe 75% of the native-born men have been circumcised, and yet the United States has the highest rate of HIV infection.
Yes.
In the industrialized world.
Right. And that's how silly it is to entertain the idea that if we only circumcise babies, we could clear up the whole HIV epidemic. I mean, it's absolutely absurd.
And it goes along at the same time that there's a movement to understand circumcision and to understand that babies are conscious and that babies are fully present, and mothers and fathers that are now giving birth are educating themselves. The internet has opened up the opportunity for people to really educate themselves about what's been going on in the medical field and with them and their babies. It's really
yes.
Seems like a battle going on.
Well, we really, really depend heavily on independent thinking and independent thinkers among our citizens who question things.
Yeah, so these people that are advocating for home birth, and they're choosing and preparing for home birth, and they're choosing not to immunize their children, and they're choosing to breastfeed and not circumcise, they're considered the weirdos.
Are you familiar with Dr. James?
It's not true.
No. James Prescott's research into pleasure, sensory deprivation, and violence?
Yes, of course.
Yes.
Jim is a colleague of mine.
Yes. Between the two of you, you should certainly share the Nobel Peace Prize. But his research, which was conducted at the NIH in the 60s and completely censored and buried,
yes.
Found that tactile sensory deprivation and pleasure sensory deprivation, especially in the young, was or the absence of it, was closely correlated with violence and depression in the adult.
Yes, they hit the nail on the head. They were working mostly with animals. And Jim never worked with the time before birth. That was not one of his contributions. But yeah, he nailed it. But people just weren't in a mood to accept it.
So just to stress to the listener, you're not just talking about the trauma of painful experience at birth. We're talking about the lifelong absence of ecstatic joy, and the effect that this has on essentially lobotomizing the part of the brain that's associated with empathy and altruism.
Can you say more about that?
That's profound. Say it again.
Well, you've heard about this new research coming out. I think Scientific American did an article on it last year about the vagus nerve.
Vagus nerve.
Yeah.
The
vagus
associated with the heart
and the guts.
Yes, but it's also heavily involved in feelings of empathy and altruism and feelings of well-being. And based on research back in the 80s. There's actually an article online about this this research that was conducted on the impact of circumcision on the vagus nerve.
I think I missed that.
It's pretty damning. But to get back to the long-term issues, Prescott discovered that that the absence of physical pleasure it tends to suppress feelings of empathy, and just the act of circumcision itself was in this research that I just mentioned was closely associated with a drastic reduction in the tone. I think they call it the vagal tone.
Yes.
So it's basically a recipe for creating sociopaths.
Wow.
Yes. Isn't it ironic, to say the least, that we didn't want to accept research that told us that pleasure was really important.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, what kind of a society would condemn pleasure?
Well, a society that is in the process of being warped.
Yes. Warping itself through intergenerational abuse.
Yeah,
and that's what this show is about. We're not going to really get into that with you here, Dr. Chamberlain, but that is really what we're looking at, the bigger picture of how all of these things have come together to create this huge warp in humanity. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you were talking about the preconception and the gestation and creating a human being that is wanted and loved and supported.
Yes. When we were talking about that, it occurred to me that about 5,000 years ago, people in the Far East were looking at pregnancy in a way that is becoming fashionable now. That is, they were early discoverers of the fact that the state of the mother's mind and heart, her emotional life, her physical life, even the food that she was given in the family, all of these were important. If the baby was going to be emperor-making material, I mean, they had this, they developed this idea that you had to treat every woman that was pregnant like royalty. She needed to be treated like a princess or
Absolutely.
A queen, because only then would you get the kind of environment in that womb that could produce a member of the royal family, a great leader, a great mind, a philosopher, whoever. They believe that. And there was a very popular book called Kuan Yin's Handbook of Pregnancy, really, in our way of talking. And that was popular in Japan and China and Korea 5,000 years ago.
Every woman should be treated like, you know, pregnant or non-pregnant. I mean, we should all be treated like royalty because we are manifestations of the divine principle of creation.
Yes, that's a very special view, and it doesn't always represent the general mind of people or the habits of people. I mean, look at in history how much cruelty has been done to women just because they were women.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They were regularly abused. They were routinely abused. They were beasts of burden. They could be bought and sold. They could be dismissed. You could just say, we're divorced, and that was it. Well, there's lots of history that's on the negative side. But you're speaking for the divine positive, that at the center of who we are is something virtuous, beautiful, and whole. And if you look at history, there's been a continuing dynamic struggle between light and dark, and all the positive and the negative. And women got caught up in this for a long time. We're only learning now to be much more careful and respectful of women. Look at the women's movement, the women's revolution. This is not long ago.
Right.
When we had to be corrected about how we were thinking about women and the assumptions we were making and how we treated them.
And women are the ones who are bringing forth this new life.
Well, yeah.
And so it's what you're saying is just profound. And the difference, like, we could make right here in Columbia, Missouri, or in Missouri, or in the United States, or wherever people are listening, the profound difference that we could make if we regarded that woman and that baby with the highest, regardless of what your beliefs are about the divine and God and all that, but just that she's bringing forth this life.
We're talking about the creation of a new human race, literally. How to do it. We know how to do it.
We have it in us, but we have a lot of mixed up ideas about it, and we end up screwing up. And it's kind of a double problem here, that mistreating women as a routine down over the centuries automatically meant that the baby inside was nobody. There wasn't anybody to consider yet inside. And so we made ourselves totally ignorant about babies, and that made us very vulnerable to when the scientists came along and said, these babies don't have a language, what's the use of talking to them? They don't know what's happening to them in the womb anyway, so forget trying to do anything, wait until it arrives. And this is the appalling ignorance, like a shadow hanging over our culture. And if we persist in thinking that that's who babies are, we're going to end up doing all the wrong things. And those babies are going to take it all inside. They're getting their education in the womb. And it's a deep kind of education that is what I was referring to as unconscious memory and learning. It's not that they can tell you out loud what happened.
It's
you have
the building
to find
block.
Out by watching that they're upset. And, of course, there's been this veil over the womb. We haven't been able to watch them. We haven't known what was going on. And we managed to stay ignorant and believe whatever the heck we wanted about nothing going on in there.
But now there is no excuse. Now people who claim to be medical professionals really have no excuse to not know about this research.
Amen. Yes, of course. It's appalling.
And we are so grateful for people like you who have been out there talking about this for 30 years, and the impact that your work can have on this society is just amazing. And we have about 5 minutes, so I want to ask you if you have anything you want to say in closing, Dr. Chamberlain, and if you'd like to say something about your upcoming book.
And your website.
Well, the website is full of information about pre- and perinatal psychology. We call it birthpsychology.com. All one word, birthpsychology.com. My book, Windows on the Womb, Your First 9 Months, will be quite an introduction for people to be reading what was happening to them for the first 9 months of their existence in the womb. Because that story is not well known. I hope the whole world can wake up about what a human being really is. You know, we haven't treated the baby as if it were human. I mean, we thought of it as pre-human or partly human.
Weird.
Or later it'll be human or something like that. But what the evidence all points to is that these babies are us. You know, we know the store, right? But it's the truth. Babies are us. So all the good things we've discovered about ourselves in this last century is true of the babies. They're copies. They're human beings like we are. They don't wait to become human. They're already human when they start.
Hmm. And that prenatal period, the way you describe that, is like, that's the foundation. That's the building block.
That's where the action is. I'm convinced of it. Our education for life is in the womb of the mother. And if that womb is a war area, a war zone, that child is not going to come out of it the way another child who is in a peaceful zone will come out. We get designed around our mother's environment. Can't help it.
So a child who's born in a very, or gestated in a very loving and peaceful environment is very unlikely to be a violent person. And conversely, somebody who's gestated in a very violent home, or it doesn't even have to be very violent, but an abandoning one where one's abandoned and there's a lot of trauma and stress going on, that child could grow up to be a person with a neocortex that understands concepts of society like, oh, we should have peace on the planet. And they could actually want that.
Yeah.
But there's a part of them that is in conflict. Could they ever really be like that totally peaceful person?
It's asking for a miracle. This development that we all have in the womb is not a factory assembly line. Everybody is not stamped out and gets the same parts. That's a delusion, a fantasy. Day by day and hour by hour, our body is put together from the experience of the environment, including the emotions of the mother, the thoughts of the mother, the diet of the mother, the actions of the father. Moment by moment, the construction takes place around the quality of the environment. There's no escaping it. And there's no way after that's all done, you can go back and change it. You know?
That's huge.
That is our indoctrination for life there in the womb.
So
the die is cast. And if you're looking for the origin of gang members on the streets of Chicago, I can tell you where they come from. They come from the wombs where they're not recognized as being anything or anybody. There's a vacuum of relationships. They don't have any kind of significant relationship with anybody, mother, father, siblings, anybody. You use the word abandoned. Well, they are, but they're in a vacuum. where relationships are not being prepared for.
I am so sorry, but we are running out of time. We could talk to you for a very long time, and I know we're going to have you back on to talk more about this.
You're welcome. Thanks for letting me in. I appreciated the words that I've heard from you guys.
It's so good to talk to you. I've long respected your research, and I'm serious. You and Prescott should be getting the Nobel Peace Prize. Certainly, if Henry Kissinger is worthy of it, you people should have had it a long time ago.
Because the words that you've shared with us today are so important that we're talking about circumcision, and it's really clear that if we begin to look at this being in the womb and from conception, from before conception, certainly through the gestation, we're going to start changing the way we treat this baby at birth and circumcision. We're going to look back and we're going to wonder why, how could we have been so barbaric?
Right.
And I want to wish you well on your trip to Europe. And again, thank you so much for being with us, Dr. David Chamberlain, author of The Mind of Your Newborn Baby.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations to you both for having this show.
It's an honor. Thank you.
Up next is the tech guys. Big change of flow here. We're going to go from this to talking about technology, and we'll see you next week, and our guest will be Marilyn Milos of NoCirc.